All right, folks, you are listening to the Ishai Fleischer Show here on thelandofisrael.com. We have a great show for you, and it's going to be from Jerusalem to the world, and you're a part of it wherever you are. On today's show, we're going to have some spiritual cafe with Rabbi Mike Foyer. We're going to end off the book of Shemot, the book of Exodus, and we're going to enter Purim as well, and then we're going to talk about Jewish self-defense in light of the situation out there in the streets of Israel. We're going to deal with a defense expert, Avi Capone from CaponeDefense.com. So we have an action-packed show full of spirituality, the Jewish empowerment, the return of the Jewish people to the land of Israel, the return to Jewish strength, the return to Torah. It's all happening here. The Renaissance is right here in front of us. All we have to do is bite into this amazing apple, this amazing gift that God has given us, and we can do that here on thelandofisrael.com, the Ishai Fleischer Show. Buckle in, because here we go. All right, folks, you are listening to the Ishai Fleischer Show, broadcasting on thelandofisrael.com, directly from Jerusalem to the world, and you're a part of it wherever you are. Out there, you are right now. If you're in your car, you're driving, and you're hearing this, if you're walking somewhere, you are right now in Jerusalem with me. Not only with me, but also with Rabbi Mike Foyer on Spiritual Cafe. Rabbi Mike, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much, Ishai. It's great to be here.
And we are in Beit Midrash Sulam Yaakov, sulamyaakov.com, and we are learning Torah. And we need some Torah right now because the nation of Israel is under fire, maybe a tad depressed. It's not very Adar-ish out there in that just last night, a slew of attacks in Jerusalem, in Yafo, in the various capitals, wherever you think that is safe to be, it doesn't seem to be safe to be. The outbreak of jihad zombies continues out there, and it's like surreal. And even grotesque, we saw images yesterday of a Jewish man getting stabbed in the neck, pulling out the knife and stabbing the attacker to death. It's gruesome. It's almost whimsical in its gruesomeness. It's like, what is going on out here? You know, it's wild stuff. My wife Malka said to me this morning, you know, she manages a very big Facebook page with almost 400,000 people called Step Up for Israel, and she's like, what is an image I can do today to give people, you know, give people strength today? We got to give people strength, Israel strength. And I came up with my idea of, like, you know, I'm a big fan of that angel that Joshua sees and King David sees, you know, that angel with the sword drawn. Also Bilam sees him. But, you know, she said it wasn't exactly right. But the bottom line is we were looking for some kind of image. And the other image that I saw today, which really inspires me, is this is a little trite, but just seeing Jerusalem being built, just seeing people and children, very pregnant women. I saw a lady today who was carrying more than her load, more than her share should possibly carry. And yet the Jewish people are fruitful. They're multiplying and Torah is being learned. And that gave me hope. And yet there's no real channel for the anger and for the frustration that people are feeling, even with the Vice President of the United States in town. And maybe the terror show was for him. But indeed, that there's a palpable frustration out there in the air.
Yeah, and you said that the solution, or if not the solution, at least a reaction, is learning Torah. And I think that's because when chaos breaks out, it's also an opportunity to touch source. You know, that I feel that so much of what's happening around us is a response to the structures that we've built in the last 100 years, which have been amazing,
right,
but are starting to show themselves as inadequate to take us to the future. And one of the primary structures, to my great sorrow, that built this country was a rejection of the vision of the role of the Jewish people as the keystone to redemption, as it is written into the Torah. And here we are at the end of the book of Shemot, of Exodus, which is known in the rabbinic sense as Sefer HaGeulah, you know, the book of redemption. And so it's a tremendous opportunity right now, as things feel like they're cracking, to say, well, you know, when things crack, it's true they fall apart, but the mystics teach us that a seed has to rot in the ground before a tree can grow.
I work in Hebron. I'm the international spokesman of the Jewish community of Hebron, And I just got a very in-depth tour of the cemetery there.
Mm-hmm.
The ancient Jewish cemetery.
No pun intended.
And in that cemetery, there's a large area that was plowed over by the Jordanians. As is their custom, so too on the Mount of Olives. And there's pictures before and after, before 1948 and after. Before 1948, a large cemetery with a big marker for the 67 Jews who were murdered in the 1929 riots. Big, big cemetery. After 1948, plowed over, looks like a regular field. You just could not tell. However, in the eastern corner of that cemetery is an area where some of the great Torah scholars, the Reshit Chochma, the Chesed LeAvraham, there's others, great Talmidei Chachamim, some people say the Ramban. There are great Torah scholars that were buried there, and they were untouched. And this is the same thing that also happened with the Jordanians on the Mount of Olives. When the tractor got to the tomb of the Or HaChaim HaKadosh, it just flipped over and again until they decided not to touch the tomb of the Or HaChaim HaKadosh. There's something. Why do I say this? Because Torah, I don't think that Torah is the answer to violence. I think that there should be a state understanding that we should defend ourselves, we should fight back, we should destroy the jihad, and so on and so forth. There's a certain derech eretz, a certain simple reasonable logic that has to come before Torah. At the same time, the Torah is our anchor. And what I mean to say is the violence of the enemies would never touch the true Torah scholars, the true people who are connected to the higher spheres, to the real source of God.
Yeah, and what I meant by touching source is that in my mind, the Torah is the source code. Or, you know, in biological terms, it's the DNA.
And the genome.
The genome. So we as the Jewish people in any given time in history are the phenome. We're the embodiment of that. And you know what happens when a particular embodiment faces an environment which is not conducive to its survival? It dies. But the process of evolution is the process of that genome constantly finding a form which is more fit to its environment. And I really believe that we live in a time right now, and it's not just us. I mean, look around us in the region. You look also in the United States, what's happening is the codes, legal, moral, spiritual codes, which have constructed the world in which we live, right? The forms which they've taken are starting to break down. And the question is, which ones will survive and thrive in this new environment, and which ones will go the way of the dodo, as they say,
right?
And we, as the Jewish people, living on the promise of the God of the promise of God, you know that here you go, here's the code. Your task is to keep living it. It's going to be tough. It'll be tough in Poland. It'll be tough in Spain. It'll be tough in North Africa.
Right.
But when you get home and you plant it here, it's going to grow into a tree which will never be uprooted. And the ground is fertile right now. We have that opportunity to touch that source and let ourselves take a new form, which can redeem the world.
It's interesting you say about fertile ground. You know, what ground needs is upheaval. You literally have to upheave.
You have to turn it.
You have to turn it and then aerate it. And sometimes that itself is the process of growth. I think also that in a time of chaos, and I sense, at least from my kind of read on social media, which is a way to kind of touch the pulse
of the nation.
Of nation or and other peoples that are around you, there is definitely a sense of chaotic. There's something chaotic in the air right now.
Yeah.
In the American elections, which have an influence on the world, certainly here in Israel with these stabbings, something about Torah, which is eternally grounding, eternally giving you a kind of solace that in a chaotic world, the anchor of truth, the anchor of kind of stability, of stillness, is the Torah. Although the Torah itself is not still, it's vibrant and vibrating all the time. Still, though, when you take that time in your day to connect to Torah, you are kind of impervious, at least for that time and with that connection, to the vicissitudes of the world. Speaking of changes, we are about to exit out of the book of Shemot. Now, the book of Bereshit, the book of Genesis, starts with the creation of the world, which is kind of beyond us, and therefore the Torah is laconic, doesn't use a lot of words about the creation of the world. It spares us a lot of commentary. And then the creation of mankind, and then the creation of a Jewish nation. That's the basic story. Now, the beginning of the book of Genesis's creation, and at the end, and there's going to be this like rise in the middle, and in the end, the Jewish people are going to be subjugated. They're going to go to the exile in Egypt. The opposite is the book of Shemot, the book of, you call it the book of Geulah, the book of Exodus. What's going to happen here is that we're going to first have Exodus, i.e. redemption. And then from this human and familial redemption, we're going to go back to creation. The end of the book is the end of the creation. It mirrors the opposite of the book of Genesis. The end of this book that we're in right now is, what is it, five Torah portions that are all dedicated to the creating of this Mishkan. One could even accuse the Torah, ostensibly, of being repetitive. It's so, the certain details are repeated, and they're being first conceived of, then explained, and then actually made, and then finally
put into place.
It's like if I was reading this book for the first time, I'd be like, whoever wrote this book really wants me to understand the issue of the temple.
Or they need an editor.
Or they need a?
Editor,
yeah. I would think that, but I would be, if I believed that it didn't need an editor, I would say, wow, God really, or whoever wrote this book really wants me to know that a temple is important, and this is the mirror of the creation of the world.
Right. It's not just that it's important. There are two key lines, I think, that illuminate what you're saying. And this idea that this is essentially the finishing of a new phase of creation. And they are, if you look at the end of the 39th chapter, right, after everything has been made, before it's all been quite put into service, it says, Vayar Moshe et kol ha-malacha, Moshe saw all of the work, and it's been done exactly as God commanded, and he blessed it. You know what the parallel is? Vayar Elohim ki tov ma'od. Right? God saw that what God had done was good. Right? That's what we saw back in the first story of creation, but don't forget, there was no evil then. The good there means that creation was a reflection of the divine intention. It was good in the, you know, aesthetic sense, like it was fit to the will of its maker. Here, Moshe says the same thing. He looks at the Mishkan and says, ah, this is exactly what God wanted, and then he blessed it. And then in case you missed it, only a few lines later, at the end of the next chapter, right, it says, Vayichal Moshe et ha-malacha. Right, that he completed all malacha, which is exactly how Shabbat is introduced. Right, Vayechal Elohim, right, et kol asher asah. God completed everything he did. So the question is, why? Why is the Mishkan, the tabernacle, a microcosm of creation? Because it essentially brings creation into its fulfillment. Right, because what did God want? And this is the question that the whole world is dancing around, right? Why creation? The biggest question in creation is why. And this repetitive series, as you called it, is actually coming to drive home to us. Please don't miss it. Please don't miss it. This is why. Because God wants to be with us. He wants to be with us. And we don't have to get into the details right now of why each piece matters. And it does. Right,
but of course it does. I wanted to clarify that if anybody didn't understand that I was being facetious, or you know, kind of using humor, those things that I was saying were like as what you may have thought. Certainly, I believe and I know, and Jews throughout the world and throughout generations know that every word of the Torah is perfect and it's there to teach us something. And the whole Talmudic system, by the way, is based on the fact that we believe that every letter and every nuance and every word that may seem extraneous is coming to teach us something.
Yeah, but it's your facetious statement is giving voice to a real concern that people have. You know, when I teach Jewish law, I hear this question often. I'm sure we've mentioned it here before. People say to me, does God really care about that? Does God really care if I stick the milk spoon in the meat pot? Does God really care if I, you know, flip on a light switch on Shabbat? Whatever the question is. So I always have two answers for a student. First of all, would you want a relationship with a God that didn't care? Meaning, is there anything God doesn't care about? Really? The other thing, which if I have a good enough relationship, I often point out is, be honest, what you're saying is that you don't care. Meaning, when people say, does God really care about that? What they really mean is, well, how am I supposed to care about that? And then, do you want to live in a world where people don't care about what they do, where they believe their actions don't matter?
I think also there's an element of, I know better. I'm creating God in my image.
Yeah.
Meaning to say, God is subordinate to me and my understandings. and I understand better than him, and therefore I can psychoanalyze God. I don't think he should care about this at all.
Well, that's just in a more sophisticated way of saying, and I don't care about this particular thing.
Right.
And my point about this parallelism is that all the overwhelming detail, which culminates in this vaychal, right? There's a wholeness to it. Right, is begging and pleading with us, if you want God to dwell within you, then you must care about everything. Now, every piece has its place, every people has its role, every person has their task. We're not all the same, but they have to fit together in an amazing harmony in order that the presence of God should dwell within. And that's how this book ends.
And the book indeed does end. The book of Shemot ends. It's also the Pesach book, you know. It's the book that's the book of Cecil B. DeMille. You know, it's the Ten Commandments. You got all that drama, and we're going to be transitioning to a very different book, the book of Leviticus, the book of Vayikra, which has here it's going to have if we've created the mechanism of the temple. Well, how does it actually work? What are the laws involved? It's called Leviticus, as in the laws of the Levites. There's also going to be a lot of social laws, and I'm thankful when you're a kid, the book of Bereshit and the first part of the book of Shemot, of Genesis and Exodus, you can connect to the book of Leviticus. You're like, oh my God. As you get older, though, you really start to enjoy very much the more legally challenging and the blueprint Torah portions. I know I've enjoyed this year, especially with your help, Rabbi Mike Foyer, here in Spiritual Cafe, the blueprint parts of the Mishkan, of the Tabernacle.
I'm very excited for our exploration of holiness, because that's my understanding of what the entire book of Leviticus is about.
Let me break that down for people. Holiness. Does mankind possess the knowledge to make holiness happen? Does he have, and holiness is the prerequisite for, purity is a prerequisite for holiness, and do we know how to do that? And just very quickly, I'll have to illustrate my point here. I don't know if we discussed it here, but maybe we discussed it, but I was, did I ever tell you the story about myself? Did I talk about this last week about me being on the Hermon?
I
was in the army in the Hermon, on the white snowy mountain of Israel, the tallest mountain in Israel. Anyway, these I was in a closed military zone. Suddenly, this big truck comes up. This truck was a semi, like a really big truck. And out of the semi truck pop out six ultra Orthodox Jews in black. Their blackness stood out on the white facade of the snowy mountain that I was at. And they came out with pitchforks. That's when I started getting nervous. You know, six ultra-Orthodox men jumping out of a truck in the middle of the Hermon in a closed military zone with pitchforks. One could get nervous. I didn't know if they were a new secret team.
I would remember if you told this story.
I thought maybe that they were a new secret unit to attack Hezbollah. But I didn't know what it was meant to do. And suddenly what they were doing is they didn't stop. The weirdness didn't stop there. They took out these big nylon bags, big ones, like a big one, construction bags, big construction things that the cranes lift.
Uh-huh.
And they proceeded to take out box cutters and cut slits in the bottoms of these bags. It's like, okay, that's weird. And they were ruining these bags by cutting slits in them. And then they moved the bags close to snow, big snow piles. They climbed on top of snow piles and they pitched forked pieces of that snow into these bags. Then they had a little forklift. No joke. They had a little forklift, which came on the semi, and took these bags and stuck them onto what turned out to be a refrigerated. The truck was actually refrigerated. What is going on? It turns out that a mikveh in the north of Israel. This was exactly, the rains had stopped. There was still snow on the Mount Hermon. A mikveh had drained out in Metula. Somebody pressed the wrong button. All the mikveh, the rainwater left. And their only way to bring water in a state of purity, and not in a state of, because if you would use even a shovel to pick up the snow, it would be, why pitchforks, right?
Yeah, I was wondering that.
Why pitchforks? Because the pitchforks were only being used to break the snow so that it would fall almost naturally and never be carried in a vessel, which would disqualify it from being a good mikveh. And this whole crazy system of why the bags had these holes, so that, again, they wouldn't be a good vessel. It would be as though the snow had fallen. Now, one listening to this, they transported this this snow to the mikvah, dumped it in there. I wish I would have seen that part, and it became holy. It became water that was able to sanctify and purify and continue proper Jewish marriage and all that. That's a secret knowledge. You have to have the ability to know how to transport purity. You have to know how to create a mikvah. To me, that was the ultimate in the Jewish secrets, to know how to be able to bring purity and holiness, and that one shovel brand would disqualify it. Amazing.
And what makes it to me so uniquely Jewish, and how we differ from the nations of the world, it's all in the service of intimacy of relationship. As you pointed out, that the primary function of a mikvah in today's religious society is to permit a man and woman to be physically intimate together. And this is something that the nations of the world in general say that's not holy, right? That's something dirty. It's base. It's a concession to your physicality. And we'll discuss this when we get deeper into Leviticus, into Vayikra, we say, well, I just have to say it in the Jewish way, ifcha mistabra, right? The exact opposite is true. The nature of holiness is an intimate grounding in the physical reality with which the Creator gifted us, and where, as we see at the end of the book of Shemot, he so much longs to be together with us in intimacy.
So that was the story of the tabernacle. I understood that God was revealing secrets to us about how to bring him closer, how to be intimate with him. Okay, first thing, we got to shift gears now. I want to say two things. I want to thank our sponsors. First thing, our good friend Jack, who dedicates the show to Lillian, and to his sister Sarah, who we've met, are amazing people and are really part of the story, and can't wait to see them here in Israel soon, Bezrat Hashem. Amen. And I want to thank you so much for helping us broadcast Spiritual Cafe. I want to thank the good folks at thelandofisrael.com, especially Ari Abramowitz and Jeremy Gimpel, for making such an amazing network. And this network is going to be broadcasting more and more great stuff. I also want to thank a new sponsor, which is Capone Defense. We're going to talk about that in the next half an hour. Capone Defense will teach you everything you need to know about the Jewish and the Israeli way of shooting and defending oneself. So important today, but not only the physical act of defending oneself, but also the intellectual and spiritual component of what that means to be a Hebrew warrior in the modern age. That's CaponeDefense.com. And I also want to thank the good people of Chevron, who let me do the show, and I work there as the international spokesman for the Jewish community of Chevron. And check out our website at Hebron.com. Absolutely a must. Check it out if you want to connect to the real roots of the biblical heroes. Of course, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and their amazing wives, the mothers of the Jewish people, are buried there. I also want to thank Sulam Yaakov, sulamyaakov.com. Rabbi Mike Foyer, you're the educational director here, and you also have a brand new series on Esther, the book of Esther, which
on the joy of the month of Adar and leading up to the holiday of Purim.
Okay, and people can check that out at sulamyaakov.com.
They sure can.
Absolutely. If you need more Rabbi Mike, then and you do, so go check out sulamyaakov.com. Now, let's shift gears into Purim. The fact is that I'm not going to be with you in any physical sense in the next 2 weeks. I'm going out to the United States of America. I'm going to be in New York and Washington for the APAC conference. I'm going to do some radio from there, hopefully, but we will not have the regular Spiritual Cafe for the next 2 weeks. I'll try to do some Spiritual Cafe wherever I am, but it won't be with Rabbi Mike until we come back, and I'm looking forward to saying Shehecheyanu when I get back here, even without God's name in that case. But in any case, I want to tell you a little story about Godcast. Do you know what Godcast is?
Yes, I do.
Okay. If you go to YouTube, you can find these cute little cartoons on the Torah portion and other Jewish holidays called Godcast. It's G-D-Cast. And sometimes it's cute and sometimes it's a little fluffy, but you know, I applaud the attempt to try to, you know, turn Torah into an entertaining thing so that people can connect to it one way or another. However, I must say that I was disappointed, shocked, and my eyes opened when I saw the Godcast rendition of Purim. Why is that? Because the whole story proceeds Esther is the heroine. Everything proceeds throughout the whole story. You know, Esther's hidden, and Haman wants to destroy the Jewish people. And then at some point, Esther rises up because she's a proud Jewish woman, and she rises up and she says to the king, "Hey, king, this Haman is trying to kill our people, and we are a proud people. Please do something about this." And the story of Godcast ends that the king says, "No problem, I will take care of it." Meaning to say, they change the end. Everything is normal until the very end of the story. The part that Godcast deleted was that the Jews actually fought.
Yeah.
The Jews, the king, so the goy, he took care of it. The Gentile king, he took care of the problem. We just, all we had to do was just say, "That's not right." We just wrote a letter to the editor. We made a rally. We said,
called our senator.
We called our senator. We said, "There's no moral equivalency." And we stood out there, you know, at what is Dag Hammarskjöld Plaza at the UN. You know, and that was it. And it just got solved that way. There was no need for Jewish fighting and Jewish anger. It was just stand up and stand up for truth. I'm a Jew. I'm a proud Jew. I'm a proud New York Jew, and everything is going to be okay.
It's funny you say that because I've had a number of my students. I teach also at the Pardes Institute for Jewish Studies. Wonderful place. Deeply caring, committed, extremely liberal environment. And I've had a number of my students in the last few weeks approach me troubled by the end of the Megillah. And by the way, some of my former colleagues there are involved in the Godcast. It doesn't actually surprise me that that's the ending. Because, first of all, I've seen that there's a very low tolerance for messiness. Right? People have this idea that redemption should be clean, smooth. Right? As someone once said to me, "But do you really think redemption's going to come through fighting?" And my response was, "Have you ever read the Bible?" Right? The Bible's a messy book. And we don't have to get into whether violence is glorifying and whether it's a good... I don't even have to get into that question. It's just actually real life. People live in a theoretical construct of redemption, and they want it to be smooth, number one. Number two, I think that the deep challenge of employing violence in order to change the world is that it can be evil or it can be good. Right, and the difference between the two, as far as I can tell, is actually the moral clarity that what you're committed to is God. And that's dangerous because, let's face it, there are people all around us right now who are very committed to what they believe to be God, are committing horrible acts of violence, and I don't think any of us would agree that redemption will come from there. But nevertheless, you can't avoid the reality of the end of that story, which is v'nahafochu. Right? It's the opposite. We did to our enemies what they sought to do to us. And by the way, what happens in response? All the peoples around us see what? Our greatness. And many of them come over the side of Am Yisrael. And the irony, the really sad part of what you just said is that, but the reason that the Purim story is in many ways a failed redemption is because at the end we're still the slaves of Achashverosh. We're not able to push that process to its end. So in that movie, to say that Achashverosh solved the problem is actually to embrace the fact that we're the slaves of Achashverosh instead of free people.
It has a lot of responsibility to free people, and one of those to be free people. One of those people that had tremendous amount of responsibility on his shoulders was Mordechai. Now, contrary to popular belief, the end of the Megillah says Mordechai is very popular, and that's actually there to tell you that he wasn't really so popular in the beginning. In fact, in a lot of ways, he was quite annoying, a dangerous zealot. Why are you endangering us by not bowing down? There are halachic leniencies that you can take in order to bow down to Haman. Please, you're bringing a holocaust upon us. You're endangering us with your capital T truth, and you're really not being reasonable. And you know, go with the flow. Why are you out? Don't be outside of the kihila. Don't be outside of your poresh min etzibur. You're separating yourself from Jewish society. A lot of people didn't like him. Even the end, the Megillah says that he was. Oh. That's right. He was liked by the majority of his brothers. There were still people who were like, you know what? I don't think so. I never liked him.
They were still Jews.
And there's another aspect of that. You know, Mordechai. At that point, in the beginning point of the story, he was actually nothing like the rest of the Jews. He did not represent them. He was different than them. His spirit was different and more, I don't know, more radical, more intense, more zealous. But when Mordechai, when Haman, I got confused between Haman and Mordechai. That happens sometimes.
That was a little early. That's right. It has to happen eventually.
When Haman encounters Mordechai, he says, I got to kill him and all of them. I'm Mordechai. They are the people of Mordechai. And he senses within the Jewish people the possibility to be like that guy who right now does not represent them.
I mean, in a sense, every movement that has wanted to dominate the world has understood that in order to do so, it's had to destroy the Jewish people. And in particular, the movements that are universalist. I mean, the reality is at the beginning of the Megillah, when there are seven different advisors, all of whom are speaking to the king in different voices, and there's kind of conflict. So it doesn't really matter. The Jews are fine. They're just another voice in the harmony. It's only when Haman arises above them all and wants to concentrate powers in his hands so he can remake the world in his own image, that's when the Jews are absolutely necessary to destroy. Every universalist movement we have seen has needed to destroy the Jewish people. Listen, people don't like to call Nazism a universalist movement, but it absolutely was. It wanted the whole world to be in one way. Communism, the whole world to be in one way. Right now, Islamism, the whole world in one way. The church in its day when it was crusading, the whole world in one way. What unites them all? They have to get rid of the Jews. Today, even this humanism that masquerades as this great liberal force in the world, is the Jews are a bone stuck in their throat. And in particular, like you're pointing out, the Jews that refuse to be like them. The ones that say, whoa, not so fast. We actually have a deep root in being particular and not universal, because our mission is universal redemption, which is about everyone being who they are and not everyone being the same.
That's a very powerful point. That is indeed a very powerful point about universal. It's so ironic. It's through that particularism, which is a kind of a realer, more a greater respect for the individual and for different nations and for different differences, that people can come together. It's when you try to erase those differences, they're not really coming together. They're actually destroying, and all those movements also destroyed people.
Yeah, there's a deep intolerance in all universalism, because as long as you're on the inside, then we tolerate you. But if you're not willing to be us, forget it. And people often accuse us, but what they miss is that we're particularists in the sense of we're the Jews and nobody else is. But we are universalists in the sense that you don't have to be a Jew to have a relationship to God.
But Jews are sometimes cantankerous also amongst themselves. And it was when Jews were kind of divided amongst themselves that Haman came to exploit that kind of weakness.
Absolutely.
And he says it. He said there's a divided people amongst you. And that meant to say that there's no kind of Jewish unity. One of the reasons that I'm flying to America and to APAC, and I have to remind myself of this, is not for issues. It's not for issues, and it's not for rights, and it's not for asserting our rights, and it's not for the dialogue, debate, and diatribes. What it's really for is to connect with brothers and sisters, and to unite those people. And I think Hebron also unites all the Jewish people, because that's where the Jewish family comes from. And not to not allow it to be divided, to not allow this great divide between North America and the mass of Jews there and the Jews of Israel, these two big poles, not to allow that rift to widen. And that was exactly the antithesis of the divided peoples in the Megillah. Megillat Esther is when Esther says, Lech knoset kot kol yehudim, gather all the Jews, unite them together. And that unity is not through a universal erasure of differences. It's through love. It's through uniting in those differences.
And you use the model. It's through family. I mean, if you think about it, we're the people of one, right? One God, one people, one land, 12 tribes.
12 tribes.
Right?
And many families.
Exactly. Because you're a parent. You know you have three children, right? I've got five. And the reality is love is one thing, but it's particular for each child, right? The goal, of course, is not to make the mistake of it being exclusive. But, you know, you wouldn't want an impartial judge in place of a loving father, right? That the idea that you're supposed to give the same thing to every child is a myth. You're supposed to give to every child exactly what they need. And in the same way, the 12 tribes represent the fact that we wouldn't want American Jewry to be just like Israeli Jewry, nor would I want the Haredim to be just like, you know, the secular world, or this one to be just like that. No, but we need to cultivate this sense that we're part of one family.
Okay, and on that positive note, in the background I hear a siren, and I'm praying immediately that it's not another attack. I'm hoping it's just another Jewish woman having a baby here in Yerushalayim. Say amen.
Amen.
All right, and the Jewish people are right now in a Purim-like fight. They're being called to fight for the right to exist. Wherever you are out there, I want you to get up and shout. Be part of that. Be part of Jewish strength. And that Jewish strength, as we saw in the Megillah, is not just about returning to the ability to have Jewish strength and the ability to direct violence against those who are violence against us. It's also the return to Jewish culture, to Jewish Torah. And as we said, I think we mentioned it last week, that on Shavuot we may have been given the Torah, but on Purim we receive the Torah. Bezrat Hashem, we will receive the Torah. Rabbi Mike, I'm going to miss you for the next 2 weeks. Wish me lots of luck.
You should travel safe. I bless you that you should, at least in heart and soul, if not in body, bring home Am Yisrael.
All right, thank you so much. Amen. And we will be back on Spiritual Cafe, getting ready. We'll try to remember what happened on Purim if we can, and we'll get ready for Pesach in 2 weeks. Till then, folks, be strong out there. Stay connected. Write me an email, yeshai@thelandofisrael.com. And any email to Rabbi Mike, I'll forward him immediately. Stay tuned, stay strong, and stay connected. And shalom. All right, folks, I hope you enjoyed that interview with Rabbi Mike Foyer. And Spiritual Cafe got you ready for ending the book of Exodus, the book of Shemot, and coming into the new book of Vayikra, and also getting ready for Purim, and also getting ready to have the spiritual fortitude to fight back against the enemies of Israel. Now let's get some physical fortitude with Avi Capone from CaponeDefense.com, who is teaching us not only the spiritual fight, but the physical fight, the return to Jewish strength here in the land of Israel. Here's Avi Capone. All right, folks, you are listening to the Yishai Fleischer Show here on thelandofisrael.com, broadcasting live from Jerusalem to the world, and you're a part of it wherever you are. Right now, I'm in beautiful Gush Etzion. There's an amazing restaurant here, which is called it's called the Chamama, the Hot House, and everybody comes here. It's packed out. We're having a lot of fun here. People are smiling at me as we're doing radio. But what's interesting about this kind of full restaurant and its atmosphere is that it's very short distance from the Gush Etzion Junction, which is a junction that has seen a lot of violence in the recent past in this wave of terror, which is kind of surprising because this is such a normative part of Israel. And yet it's under attack. And even now, as we're talking, I think I hear an army chopper overhead. Now, you've heard me talk a lot about the following topic on the show. And that is that Zionism is a return to the land of Israel for sure. And it's a return to the Torah and to the way the commandments were fulfilled in the past before we left the land and went into exile, certainly. It's also a return to the Hebrew language. And it's also a return to to agrarian, working the land, tilling the land, and coming back to the soil. It's really a return to the body. But one of the things that people sometimes don't remember, don't understand, is that it's also Zionism is a return to the ability to fight. It's a return to the Jewish warrior tradition, the Jewish self-defense tradition. When you have your own state, when you have your own body, you got to learn to defend it. And certainly, after 2,000 years of exile, which culminated in the Holocaust, the Jewish people returned to the land of Israel, yes, to have Jewish culture, and yes, to till the land, and yes, to have a Jewish economy, and yes, to return to Judaism, but also to Jewish defense, Jewish strength, even organized Jewish violence. Maybe that word sounds bad to you, but violence, to answer violence that wants to destroy the Jewish people, is right, it's just, it's moral. And one of the problems that we're having here in Israel is that the spirit of the fight has been challenged with ultra-liberal tendencies that have kind of taken the fight out of us. And there's this constant tension in Israel between being that warrior, macho, Jewish strong culture and that more universal, liberal, maybe European, post-war, post-national, let's have that latte and live in peace. Those two traditions, those two tendencies are fighting within us. However, in the various waves of terror that Israel has faced, including this latest one, there is a resurgence of a return to Jewish strength and the Jewish warrior tradition. And within that, anti-terrorist schools have flourished to teach the average citizen, the tourist, the Kitat Konanut, that's the ready response teams in places like Judea and Samaria, and guards who are kind of dot every spot in this country from the mall to the bank. Somebody's got to teach these people to be citizen warriors, to carry maybe not an M16, but a pistol, and to be ready to take on that terrorist, stabber, shooter, a suicide belt wearing somebody who's coming to destroy the Jewish people. Somebody's got to train that. And a next generation of the army, people who have been in special forces, people who are very well trained, who continued their career paths through the army, have formed these schools and have become the teachers of these institutions. And I'm sitting with one right here. Avi Capone is a major in the army. He commands in reserve units. He commands a company of elite forces, various elite forces he's trained and commanded. He was a chief instructor of the Israeli airport authorities. If you understand that in Israel, one of the most strategic and defended sites is actually the airport, because that's a place that could inflict a terrorist attack there, could inflict tremendous damage. He was the head instructor, making sure that Israeli airports are safe. He was also a four-year city council member of Givad Ze'ev, and today he's the owner and director of Capone Defense, which is a tactical combat training school, an anti-terror school, self-defense school, and teaching Jews and also other people around the world who are interested in Israeli defense how to defend themselves and how to fight those bad guys. Avi, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Ishai. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you. We're only a few yards away, a few meters away from Tzomet HaGush, the Gush Junction, which has been under attack. Explain to me a little bit about the tactical situation. Why is it that this junction has seen so much terror focus to kind of disrupt normal life here?
That's because, mainly because there is a lot of friction, of, if I pronounce it correct, between the Arab population and the Jewish population. So it is very available, you know, to do something, to do something bad in that case. You know, to throw to shoot with a handgun, to shoot with a rifle, to throw a hand grenade, to run over people with the car. So it is, you know, very simple to do. So people just do it.
The army has fortressed, buttressed this place. There is a sniper that stands in the middle, and he's looking at you. There are fences up. There's all kinds of defensive measures that are taken, and yet still there have been people killed, even post this whole kind of tactical new fortress-like situation here. Why is that?
Because defending civil crowd environment is a profession. Usually when a regular infantry soldier is learning how to do basic, you know, drills of shooting and fighting, it is good for infantry. It is not suitable for such kind of war or combat. And that's why, actually, when you put a regular paratrooper brigade soldier or Golani brigade, it is very difficult for him to be effective.
Right. So I was a paratrooper soldier, and I studied classical warfare for 6 months, 9 months. And then when we actually got to do what we're supposed to do, we were not at all trained. We were trained in classical open warfare. Had nothing to do with the police work that the army wanted from us.
I will give you an example. With the basic drill that you learn when you are in, you know, basic training in infantry, is when somebody is shooting at you, you should lay down. We call it a professional name. It's called pazatsna. And then you should identify the enemy and then shoot. When you are operating inside the crowd, it is completely different. Actually, the opposite. Because the main thing now is to narrow the incident or the effect of the incident. So shooting in while you're leaning on the floor is something, you know, not a reasonable thing to do, okay? Because you should react as fast as you can, because every second is count.
So basically you have to get as close and as fast possible towards the terrorist and in such a way that you can hit him fast. You're not going to kind of slow the situation down. You're going to speed it up yourself.
Yeah, that's correct. Because you should defend innocent people. So the time or the frame time that you should operate in is very small. We are talking about seconds. And this is a big change, you know. You cannot bring someone from the infantry and put him in such a crowd, such an environment, and expect that he will react in a professional way. Not to mention the fact that we want selective shooting, because we want to hit only the terrorist. We don't want the soldier to, you know, to shoot all over. And this is not, you don't teach it in regular or basic infantry drills. It is only when you are a professional. So this is part of the problem. Not to mention the fact that you should have a plan. It is not only the tactics. It is not only, you know, we say that the fact that the security officer have a handgun or a rifle is a brick, I think, in a wall of civil security. It is not the main thing.
What is the main thing?
The main thing is, first of all, like always, what you have in your brain, okay? Right. Which is a proper understanding of the operational situation, of the combat situation. And here it is very simple. You should react as fast as you can, because every second is count. Why? Because when a terrorist is shooting, he hit innocent people. So you should react as fast as you can. Okay, now, if you are planning something, you should plan how to narrow the damage, or how to confront it, even when it is far away from you. So actually, you need a complex array of actually what we call unarmed security, which observe and understand something who is exceptional in the routine, and then react.
Now, what was her name? Hadar Cohen. Hadar Cohen was part of a group of police officers, young women police officers, who spotted something suspicious and went up to some terrorists. They didn't know they were terrorists, but immediately sensed that something was wrong with them. Were able to identify that extraordinary situation, that something in these bunch of people. They started asking for their identification. They forced the situation, and that's when the terrorists started their act of terror. But they were surprised by the police's kind of awareness that there was something in them. And in fact, they may have, these three police officers and Hadar Cohen died in that incident, but she may have saved hundreds of thousands of lives in a would-be much worse terror situation.
That's the whole perception, actually, to plan it in such a way that actually what will happen is that you will catch them while they are organizing, you catch them in a surprise situation. So, and if, God forbid, something is happening, so you could narrow the influence of this incident. This is very important, and this is not something that the army is qualified for.
Now, you're teaching this kind of stuff to tourists who want to come by and learn a little bit, not so much, but you do that as well. But you also teach it to Israelis who are just citizens who want to be better defenders, because people like myself are armed and want to be more effective if the situation arises. You teach it also to Kitot Konanut. These are groups of first responders in towns that are actually organized semi by the army, or allowed to have weapons from the army, but they are first responders to terrorism, and also to guards all over the country, including guards that serve where I live, who are always 24-hour around the clock watching the situation. So you're training a lot of different people.
Yeah, actually we divide our activity into two parts. One of them is professional, that I cannot talk a lot about it because it is classified, but the main idea is to, in civil security, is to make sure that the problem will not happen inside your place, and if it do happen, so you can narrow the influence of the attacker. The other thing that we are doing with civilian, and including tourists, of course we are talking about the Jewish people, is actually teach them basic rules of self-defense, because a family or a person is not a security array. It's something, it's an individual. He should know basic things. We call it ABC, self-defense, which is A is avoid, B is barricade if you're in your house, and C is confront, because sometimes running away is not an option.
Avoid, barricade, or confront. ABC. Yeah. I like that. Okay, yeah. Good.
It is not my idea.
Okay, that's good.
Okay, but I learned it from someone that I respect very much. And he was a police officer, a Jewish police officer in the New York police city. And actually, it's a very good principle. So when we are working with civilians or tourists, we teach them the basic or the fundamental of self-defense with weapon. Of course, this is not enough. You should understand self-defense without weapon. And you should have some kind of tactical class, which means training all the method without the risk of live ammunition firing. Because this is also almost impossible to practice it with real ammunition. So actually, you need, it is three steps or three levels. The first is basic safety and shooting in a paper target. The second is actually understand how to defend yourself without a weapon, because sometimes in close range, you are not able to operate the weapon and you should defend yourself. And we have a lot of example. And the third step is actually the tactical class, which is give you the whole perception, including the Israeli law of when and how to implement lethal force.
And lethal force. And you also actually give talks just about the law. Just about the law of when in Israel you're allowed and not allowed to do, when you could use lethal force.
Okay, in headlines, because we can talk only in headlines now. In Israel, you are allowed to operate a lethal force, or you don't have any criminal responsibility when there is a real and immediate threat to life. Okay, but now, you know, God is in the details. So this is the frame or the headline, but in order to understand the real meaning of this, you should practice and understand and, you know, it is only a headline.
Yeah, it's situational, and you got to be aware of that situation, like you were saying. Your school, your anti-terror tactical combat school, is called Capone Defense. CaponeDefense.com. And you spell that just like Capone, like K-A-P-O-N, CaponeDefense.com. And Avi, a lot of people, when I tell them, you guys got to go check out Capone Defense, they say, what? And I tell them, you know, my friend Avi Capone. And immediately, you know, that name Capone is one that you don't identify exactly with being Jewish, and you certainly don't identify it with defense, but more with criminality.
Yeah, but we are with K.
Oh, you're with K, okay. CaponeDefense.com. Tell me a little bit about that name, and really I want to ask you, you know, another question regarding that name, which is generally like, tell me about people that grew up like yourself. How do you become a kind of person who's so concerned with Israeli defense and really creating that new tradition, that reborn tradition of the Jewish fighter?
I tell you, first of all, about the name. The name, we are in origin from Saloniki, Greece. As you know, the Germans were very efficient in Greece. And a very small part of my family saved and reached to Israel. So, you know, it is in my heart to put this name in some kind of headline, and we are still exist, we're still alive, we survive. So this is something very moving and important for me, and that's one thing. The other thing is my father. My father was not such a is not such a brave person. You know, he was a sergeant in the Armory Brigade, but he made the Six-Day War, the Yom Kippur War, and the First Lebanon War also. And I asked him, you know, when I was 13, 14, 15 years old, I asked him, okay, father, you are not the typical macho Israeli person. You are, you know, regular work, not, you know, too brave, not doing sport, you know, something like that. But why you are, you know, so dedicated in your army service, especially in the reserve? Because in Israel, you should understand the reserve is the majority of the Israeli power. So he told me, I will tell you something, my son. I always remember that we were behind the fence of a concentration camp. And now we have the privilege to actually to have our weapon, wear our uniform, and fight for our freedom. And this is a big thing. And I also believe, because this is the reason why I'm still in the age of 47 doing such a combat army reserve in my case, some kind even with the regular duty units. Okay, I cannot say more, but I am very active.
You're very active in the reserves, in defense establishment, and you also have your own defense school. So you're based, your whole life is Israeli security and defense.
Yeah. Actually, I am talking with you after a very intensive week in the army. Yeah, how to say it in English. That's the way it goes. You know, I didn't plan it so much. It's from
God takes you that way. Avi, I went to your school, Capone Defense, and I actually shot with you. I'm a person who likes to shoot. I believe in studying self defense. I believe in that's part of essential part of Zionism, and I even I understand that not even ideologically it's simple to me. A Jew should be able to defend himself. Yeah, it's not even so complicated. It's just so simple and true, and just like a kind of like duh. It's a duh moment. Yeah. I feel like it's part of a DNA thing. It's like something that should happen. In fact, I'll tell you something. I say this all the time. I say every student that's here for the year, either in university or in the yeshivot or in the girls' seminary, should have a day of shooting. I honestly believe that something magical happens to a Jew when they hold a gun in their hand, especially for the first time, because there's something that happens, a change in the consciousness that says, wow, I could be part of Jewish defense. I'm not just a galut Jew, an exiled Jew who kind of exists by the grace of the other government. I am part of Jewish defense. It's very important. Now, I spent a day with you shooting. I did a lot of stuff that I knew how to do, but I, as always, learned something new. I learned a few new things, but one of the things that stands out the most, and I just want to talk about this just to kind of explain to people a small thing that you could learn that could change everything, is that you have a little bit of a secret about how you teach handgun shooting. And what you do is you actually take out these springs. What are those things called? Those hand springs, you know, that make your hands stronger. You have to squish those things. You know, it's like something you find in a weight room. It's a handheld spring that you just hold with one hand and you try to squeeze it and close it together. And what you made us do is you made us try to close that and hold it tight and actually put something between the two parts of the handles, yeah, so that you're holding it tight and it won't fall. And then you kept our index finger outside of that and wanted us to control our index finger and move it while at the same time holding the other three fingers very, very strong. And that's supposed to mimic the action of a handgun, where you want us to kind of learn to separate the muscles of the index finger from the three fingers that are holding the handle.
Yeah.
And I was like, I never heard that. And you said that is the most important thing you could do. Yeah. in non-shooting and dry training. Tell me a little bit about your little secret here.
Yeah. First of all, now we are dealing with very, very micro tactic. First of all, our aim is to give you tools in order to function in real incident. There is a big difference between shooting a paper target than shooting in a real environment. One of the so if you want to improve, first of all, you should understand the challenge, and one of the challenges that we have is actually understand the limitation of our palm. Okay, because of the anatomic structure, there is a connection between the index finger and the other fingers. And this phenomena increases when we are in real stress. So first of all, it's actually to discover this thing. And after that, to practice it in order to have some minimum frame or some minimum ability to function in stress. So that's why we use it. Of course, it in a context of all things that we are doing in such a training, in order to improve your ability to react and to be effective in real emergency situation.
You know, Avi, in the American Army, there's a kind of phrase that says, "Don't rise to the occasion, revert to training." Don't rise to the occasion. And that's something that I think you're really teaching us as well, and what I've learned in all the various self-defense worlds that I've encountered, which is you have to practice this stuff. You have to be a surgeon of this stuff. It's in that situation, you really have to be a surgeon. You have to shoot selectively. You have to have a very sharp eye. You have to see the other people around you in the situation of a terrorist attacker, and that's something you study. It's an art. It's a martial art. Yeah, it's an art of war. It's an art of war. And it's something that, that Israel has become not only decent enough in order to defend itself, but good enough to export to the world. And people like you are actually not are sought after around the world to teach in different countries Israeli tactics, our defense systems, including shooting, our Israeli shooting style, our Israeli fighting style, all these different, called Krav Maga and other things. They are something that we've not only become good enough to stop the next Holocaust, but also to teach others how to defend themselves. I learned a lot by spending time with you at Capone Defense. The website is CaponeDefense.com. I hope to see you again there soon. And more than just the separating the index finger from the other fingers, and more than the tactics of the surgery, it's also the spirit.
Yeah.
The spirit of fighting. Tell me just one thing about
that. I tell always the young soldiers that I am instruct or people that I am in contact with that the most important thing is your spirit. Because you can have this gun, handgun, or this handgun, this rifle, or this rifle, but if you don't have the drive to fight and to win the battle, it will not help you. So when people come and ask me, what, we want these sights, and we want this magazine, and we want this rifle, you know, sometimes I laugh. Of course, equipment is something important, but the most important thing is your soul and your drive to win. And in that mean, we didn't change a lot from the days of Bar Kokhba to nowadays. So work hard, do it a lot, suffer, no. and that's the way to do it.
The fighting spirit, the Jewish fighting spirit. Avi Capone teaches it and tactics as well at Capone Defense, CaponeDefense.com. And that atmosphere and those lessons and that spirit is what keeps the Jewish people alive here in the land of Israel, of course, with the help of God. Yeah. Avi Capone, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Ishai, for having me. Good evening. Thank you very much.
All right, folks, you are listening to the Ishai Fleischer Show. I hope you enjoyed that interview with Avi Capone. So I guess we did a spiritual defense and now a physical defense. All that is part of the Jewish people's return to the land of Israel. And that's why we have to be strong in order to fulfill God's will, in order to make this thing actually happen big. We got to realize what time we're living in. We're living in a time of opportunities, a time of renewed strength, and we have to ask for more. We got to have that passion to ask for even more. And that's exactly what this network, thelandofisrael.com, is all about, and the Ishai Fleischer Show. I want to thank again the good people of Hebron, because that's where I am the international spokesman. The Jewish community of Hebron is the most incredible home for the forefathers and mothers of the Jewish people, and also for that spirit of bravery. So come check out the courage and the history and the heritage of Hebron as well. Hebron.com, landofisrael.com, and the Ishai Fleischer Show. We're all just trying to do one thing, which is to connect you to the great story of the past and the amazing destiny of the future, all under God's watchful eye as he's fulfilling the promise of the return of the Jewish people to the land of Israel. Yes, there is a covenant that's being fulfilled, and you're a part of it wherever you are. Stay tuned. More great stuff is on the way. And shalom.